Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I hope all of you have had a good week, and hard to believe today is Friday. I don't know where all this time is going, but it's going by quick. For one, it is hard to believe that my wife and I were out of town a week ago this time. And secondly, I also find it hard to believe that back at the beginning of the week, I was on the air with you guys. And now at the very, very end of the week, I'm back on the air once again. I don't know why that seems unique, but sometimes when you go 3 or 4 days not being on the air, it does seem like a long time. But the good news is that during that lull or stretch of time when I was not on the air, I was able to map out my next podcast segment episode so that I would be able to get back on the air and report what is relevant, given that we are in the midst of a unique book topic series discussion. But then again, I think all of the discussions per series that have been done have been certainly unique and worth the while. But somehow, as time passes along, I think it's also fair to say that with each new series, they all have their own unique stories. They've all been, not trying to flaunt anything, folks, but I'd like to refer to them as works of art. You have to start somewhere. You know, you have to know how to tell the story right, or stories right, I should say, and you have to be able to know how to start and end, and not just per episode, but per starting the series and when it's time to end. All of that is a work of art onto itself, with no two processes being alike in terms of podcast book topic series discussion. I know it might seem a little strange to mention all of that, but, you know, one could say it's a labor of love, and secondly, one could say it is a work of art. Either way, it's a double-edged sword that in this case, there's no wrong, it's all right. So, I'm sure many of you are wondering, though, where are we going to go forward in this next podcast segment episode to Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. Well, I know the last time we were on the air, we talked about, let me get to my page here. The last time we were on the air, I do recall Dennis Hale speaking with one of his crewmen, whom assured him that everything would be okay. As much as we would like to believe that everything would be okay, sometimes there's always that slight chance that something could go wrong. And of course, then we have to ask ourselves, just how big is this slight chance? I mean, slight to me is small. But yes, 4 out of 5 times, everything can be fine. But what about that one time when things just go so terribly wrong? Well, you know, I can only imagine what Dennis Hale must have been thinking when he as the night progressed, I should say. I can only imagine what was going on in his mind. But then again, this was nothing new to him. You know, seeing waves that may have formed around 8 or 10 feet. But for a veteran like him, he was also probably accustomed to seeing on an occasion of a 20-foot wave. If you've been a veteran out on the waters of the Great Lakes for some time, then you will have been well accustomed to seeing waves at that 15 to 20-foot high mark. And for some veterans who've been out on the waters for, say, 20 years or more, they've probably seen the occasional 25 and 30-foot waves. They do happen, folks, most notably on Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan is notorious for what are called the sister waves, and I think the same could happen on Erie and Huron, Ontario, and Superior. But Lake Michigan most notably, and the reason for that is because throughout Lake Michigan's history, there have been many violent storms, like there have been on the other four Great Lakes. But sometimes Lake Michigan has been prone for getting more sister waves because when one big wave forms, it's followed by another one shortly after, and then the third one is bigger than the first two, to when the third one comes, a wrath of destruction results so big that most people simply just don't have time to, they don't have enough time to react or get away from the inevitable being the carnage, the destruction that the waves themselves bring. And we're talking, you know, waves that are easily over 15 feet long. So the sister waves probably, to me, get to about 30 and 40 feet long. So it's best not to sometimes be out on the front of, say, Lake Michigan when the weather not only is just choppy, but when the weather is becoming rough and rougher within an hour or longer, because you never know how quickly the weather can change. And I think it's fair to say that we learned from our last episode how during the daytime things are great early in the morning, you know, not a change in the sky, but, you know, the sky is bright, the sun's shining, you know, it's a little unseasonably warm, which we learned that the middle of November of 66 was unseasonably warm, given that the start and the very end of November was bitterly cold. So, you know, Mother Nature has all kinds of curveballs up her sleeve, but it's up to us as humans as to how we're going to be prepared for whatever curveballs lie ahead. Just because it's nice outside, it doesn't mean it's going to stay that way for the rest of the day, or let alone the rest of the week, especially in the month of November on the Great Lakes. As the late Gordon Lightfoot said, with regards to Lake Superior, the lake that never gives up her dead, when the skies of November turn gloomy. In other words, nothing's ever certain. So in this podcast segment episode, going forward in this episode, we're going to get an in-depth analysis behind what happened, ultimately happens to the Daniel J. Morrell. And lastly, I do recall mentioning from the previous podcast how at around 12:15 in the on the morning of November 29th, little did Captain Arthur Crowley of the SS Daniel J. Morrell and the captain of the Edward Y. Townsend, little did Captain Connolly of the SS Edward Y. Townsend, little did both men know that come 12:15 a.m. on November 29th of 1966, that it would be the last time that either man would ever speak to one another. So now we're obviously left to wonder what is going to become of the fate of the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Will she be able to, in other words, we're going to find out if she's trying to even find a place for shelter, given that SS Edward Y. Townsend has already done so. Because I'm sure some of you are probably thinking to yourselves, why didn't the SS Daniel J. Morrell go look for shelter? Well, when we're dealing with storms, folks, it's so easy to think that shelter is nearby, but sometimes it's not always as easy to access when dealing with all the uncertainty on the waters in a matter of a short time. Well, I think it's fair to say that we better get the show on the road. Otherwise, we're going to lose track of time. So here we go with our first lead-off question. Was Dennis Hale awakened in the middle of his sleep come late evening into the early morning hours of November 29th, 1966? Yes, he got awakened by a loud banging sound, which to him resembled an anchor beating off the vessel's front section during the storm. Not too long after the first loud banging sound, a second bang shortly followed afterwards, yielding in the books that Dennis Hale brought with him, or I should say reading books that he brought. He had placed them on a shelf in his own cabin, but the second bang was louder than the first, and this bang resulted in his reading books coming off his shelf in the cabin. So if the reading books have come off the shelf in the cabin, then you know that something's not right. It obviously has to take something that loud and that severe to cause objects in your own cabin room to fall off. So for Dennis Hale, he gets himself awake. He's awakened, obviously, by the first and second sounds, these loud bangs. But he is fully awakened by the Morell's alarm. So the Morell's alarm has fully sounded. Now, before departing his cabin, he gets out his life jacket. All right, that's a good first step. I mean, life jackets are essential, folks. I mean, they're always essential no matter where you go. But in a violent storm that has already made its presence known, you have to be able to find, you need to have something on you in terms of staying buoyant, afloat, but also as a means of assuring survival. What did Dennis Hale see before him once having stepped onto the spar deck where the hatches were located? What do you think he might have stepped? What do you think he might have noticed or seen before him that, I should say, could have been very, very unusual? He probably heard about it from others whom had survived past excursions in the month of November, along when the waters got treacherous. For starters, he couldn't see the Morell's back half, along with her smokestack, which wasn't visible. Only for the stern section, being the back of the freighter, which rose out of the water. Folks, the SS Daniel J. Morell broke apart from her keel, being the vessel's backbone, and the keel is being the vessel's backbone, which runs the entire length of a ship. The keel, basically, folks, is the framework or the structure which the ship itself is built, or any ship is built, for that matter. I can't imagine being in Dennis Hale's shoes, and now all of a sudden you have seen firsthand the vessel that you've been on for some time now breaking apart from her keel. And not just breaking apart from her keel, but no longer seeing the smokestack. The smokestack has been taken out. He can't even see the ship's back half. And now he's seeing the stern section rising out of the water. To me, this kind of reminds me of the Titanic. Except when the Titanic was sinking, her bow was coming out of the water. Of course, it took Titanic 2.5 hours to sink. But usually whenever I think of either a ship's stern or a bow rising out of the water, the one ship that always comes to my mind right away is Titanic. So, given what is happening now, you know, if you were in Dennis Hale's shoes, I'm sure most of you probably would not think of doing this, but Dennis Hale did. He's obviously a veteran of the waters, and given his experience on the waters, despite having having some recent tardiness issues from past excursions, whether it was the year before or in the 1966 shipping season, Dennis Hale still has enough smarts to know various ins and outs. One in and out that he knows, and I don't know if this is just based upon experience or something that he has known for a while based upon knowing what the chances of survival are in the event something catastrophic does happen. Well, Dennis Hale was smart enough to go back to his cabin immediately, where he went about securing a heavy pea coat as a means for improving survival chances. Now, why is this pea coat so important? Well, for one, it's thicker than a standard jacket. And two, given how cold it is outside in late November along Lake Huron's waters, You know, it's one thing, yes, to have a pair of long pants on, like jeans or and a long sleeve shirt or in a life jacket. All that's great, but that's not going to ensure your survival should you be tossed out into the water. A heavy pea coat, it may not save you, but it could help modify your chances of surviving a little bit longer in the waters until help itself arrives. So yes, he went back to his cabin and secured his heavy pea coat as a means for improving survival chances. Now, I'm sure some of you are wondering, does the SS Daniel J. Morrell have a life raft or a lifeboat? She has one life raft and she has two lifeboats. You know, think about it, folks, there are 29 men aboard this ship. I know the life raft, from what I read, it could probably hold at least maybe 10 to 15 men at most. So that means that the lifeboats themselves, if you have a crew of 29 men altogether, that means roughly about on average 9 or 10 men per boat or raft. So the Morrell's forward raft was stationed between the third and fourth hatches. The crewmen from the forward section of the boat, or the vessel, I should say, being that of the bow, the crewmen along that section where Dennis Hale would have been, the crewmen either gathered around on it or stood nearby, which included some crew people tying themselves to the raft as a means of not getting swept over the waves. You know, think about it, folks. You might only have minutes to live, but if you want to modify your chances of survival, you have to be creative. You also have to remain calm, because once you start flipping out and freaking out, the harder it will become for you as the individual to calm yourself down, and for others around you whom are experiencing the same potential fate as you are, the individual. So, believe it or not, folks, all the crewmen that were that Dennis Hale himself was around were calm, even in the midst of waves rolling under the Morrell, which led to breaking the Morrell's midsection portion by sending her high in the air, only to be torn further before getting smashed down once the waves passed. So even in the midst of all this violence, chaos that the ship is enduring, thanks to Mother Nature's wrath, the crewmen are very, very calm, but they also know that time may not be on their side 100%. In other words, you may be okay at the moment, but who's to say 30 minutes to an hour from now, it could be a whole other story. Did anyone from the Morrell's stern section, being in the back, appear to be aware of what had already taken place? I was blown away at this, folks, when I read this book, and I think you all are going to be blown away per the answer I give you. I'm sure many of you all would say yes with regards to those men from the Morrell's stern section being aware of what had already taken place. But how about this curveball? The opposite answer being no. The engine ran without any issues, given the stern itself was operating under full power. But once the Morrell began breaking apart, did crewmen from behind, being that of the stern, witness the freighter's wiring becoming torn apart? You know, it's one thing to hear the sound of the ship breaking apart, but everything else that holds the keel and the cargo hold, all the nuts and bolts, folks, become torn apart. I mean, not everything at once, but if one section goes, another section will soon follow. If the wrath of Mother Nature is so violent that even a ship that's 60 years old can simply now no longer endure. The Morrell, I'm sure some of you are wondering, based upon what we learned from the last episode, that yes, the Morrell was about 15 miles north of the SS Edward Y. Townsend, her sister ship. By this point in time, given that all now that with all that's taking place, the Morrell is positioned. She's positioned She's positioned alone north of Point of Barks, Michigan. Now, Point of Barks, Michigan, that's well north of Flint, and that's located along the tip of the Thumb. I believe that when I was on the air last, I described to you all about how if you look at the state of Michigan carefully from the lower mainland, that is before making your way into the Upper Peninsula, if you look carefully at the state of Michigan from the tip of the Thumb, think of it as like your right hand. Well, doesn't make a difference, right or left hand, but the thumb, if you look at it carefully, it's like a hand, but even better, it's shaped like a mitten. So when you see the lower portion or the lower peninsula of Michigan, definitely think of it as a mitten of sorts. So yes, the Morrell was positioned alone north of Point of Barks, Michigan, where she was seeking shelter around Thunder Bay. Okay, so we can say that the Morrell did make every effort to try to seek shelter somewhere, but no matter how good your efforts are in trying to seek shelter, it's not always meant to be because of Mother Nature's fury. Now, as for Point of Barks, as I mentioned a moment ago, it's Point of Barks is located along the tip of the Thumb from the peninsula extending northward into Lake Huron and Saginaw Bay. Thunder Bay borders Lake Huron. Thunder Bay is located in Alpena County in northern Michigan. And for those of you who want to know where Alpena is, it's not too terribly far from the Mackinac Bridge, which separates the Michigan's mainland, northernmost mainland, from the Upper Peninsula. But Alpena is not far from Roger City, which was home to the SS Carl Bradley, which sank back in November of 1958, 8 years earlier, before the SS Daniel J. Morrell met her fate. Roger City and Alpena, Michigan, are in northeast Michigan, and to the west of Alpena and Roger City is Traverse City, including the cities of Kalkaska and Ludington and Cadillac. Was Captain Crawley already stationed on the raft per the vessel's front section? He was, folks. But the Morrell's upper deck room, a.k.a. pilot house, had already lost power. So if the pilot house, being the vessel's upper deck room, has already lost its power, what can a captain not do? Or anybody, let alone for that matter, what can they not do? They cannot engage in the means of issuing what's called an SOS, or what's called a distress signal, a distress call. SOS can mean one of two things: save our souls, but most commonly it's referred to as save our ship. So if you're in Captain Crawley's shoes, you know, for one, you have to be calm, given that you are the commander of the vessel, and two, you have to set a good example for your crew. But deep down inside, I can only imagine what's going through Captain Crawley's shoes, or really in his mind, I should say. What do you think is one thing that could have been going in Captain Crawley's mind at this time? Well, he's beginning to think long and hard over the fact that perhaps he should not have taken this vessel out on the water, given the intensity of the storms that have now made their presence known on Lake Huron. But at the same time, he was told to go out into the water by those above him, whom needed another load of coal to be sent to Minnesota. So, yes, he could probably challenge it if he wanted to, but it also probably would have meant, had he challenged those above him, he probably would have been out of a job. So, you know, as much as we'd like to believe that maybe captains could have more authority when making a case with regards to dealing with those above them, that's not always how it works out. So yes, Captain Crawley knows that he wishes that he had probably not taken his ship out onto the waters of Lake Huron, given the storm's intensity. But he did have the means of setting off a general alarm by battery, including parachute flares. This means of equipment was placed on the life raft. The Morrell, as I mentioned earlier, does have two other lifeboats. However, they are still remained secured in their small cranes, or what's referred to as davits, D-A-V-I-T-S, davits. Come 2 a.m. on November 29th, the SS Daniel J. Morrell began showing her signs of final moments, as many crewmen soon ultimately jumped off the vessel, where a fair number plunged to their deaths in Lake Huron's waters, which stood temperature-wise at 34 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 degree Celsius. I know some of you are probably thinking, at 34 degrees, that's not too terribly cold. Well, it's easy to assume that, but if we got into 30-degree weather, and given what's happening at the end of November, not only just with the snow, but just the constant cold temperature along the water, jumping into that water, folks, even with a life jacket on, it's still going to feel as though 1,000 knives are stabbing at you right away. So, and then plus two, if you're not fully clothed well enough, your skin's going to be exposed to the frigid weather, where if help doesn't come, in terms of that of like a rescue, another boat nearby, or say Coast Guard coming, then chances are you will die from hypothermia setting in, where your body succumbs to more colder weather and not enough heat to keep you warm. So, you know, it's one thing to be thrown overboard and, yes, have a life jacket, but it doesn't mean that the life jacket alone can save your life. What exactly took place around 2:15 a.m. November 29th, 1966, just less than 30 minutes after many crewmen had jumped off the Morrell? For starters, the SS Morrell began breaking in half, which meant her bow section got tossed around by waves which topped around, get this folks, 25 feet or greater. You know, it's one thing to maybe get to have your ship endure 10-foot waves, but now all of a sudden the bow section has broken in half, which now means that the bow section alone really is no longer immune from anything, but now she's getting tossed around by waves topping out at around 25 feet or greater. To me, this is terrifying unto itself. It truly is. Secondly, a weather mixture of icy rain and snow hurled the crewmen still aboard on the raft, along with water flooding into an already torn open cargo hold, which resulted in lifting the boat's bow high above, pointing to the air. And there again, as I mentioned earlier, whenever the first time I ever saw a picture of a boat or a vessel or ship, maybe ship I should say, the first time I ever saw a picture of a ship being that of her bow coming out of the water and into the air, it was Titanic from many years ago. Matter of fact, it was not long after Dr. Ballard and his crew discovered the Titanic with the team of French explorers. It was a joint rescue project back in the mid-1980s, where they were able to, they went about locating, obviously, some of the boilers, which ultimately led to them discovering the ship. But long story short, not long after all that happened, a book came out that was actually written by Dr. Ballard, and it was a painting of Titanic's final moments with her bow well out of the water and high into the air. So when I read this, when reading this book and learning about how the Daniel J. Morrell's bow was high above, pointing to the air, the first thoughts that came to my mind were Titanic and how she met in her final moments before plunging to her death all the way to the bottom of the North Atlantic Ocean. Loud shouts, aka voices, per crewman on the raft in the bow, reported seeing another ship right nearby. However, folks, just a few minutes later, the object nearby was not another freighter. It turned out to be the Morrell's stern section which went about directly colliding into the bow section, sending it forward only to do the same thing again. Think about it, folks. The ship's torn in two, and with everything that's coming at them in terms of these monster waves, weather. I mean, I can't imagine the stern section charging at the bow to the point where, you know, you can't stop this thing, but it certainly could cause enough damage to where everybody that's still clinging on for dear life along the bow could just be suddenly ejected. And not just ejected, but maybe some of these men could lose their lives because of the dangerous impact in which the speed of the stern is coming and hitting the bow. Yeah, just about anything is possible. I mean, nobody is safe now. I mean, this is basically not only a matter of survival, it's now every man for himself. Once the bow and the stern separated, the bow then sank, which led to the raft being thrown, or I should say ejected, into Lake Huron. Was Dennis Hale on the life raft right up to the moment a monster-sized wave came over the Morrell's deck? Yes, he along with everyone else on board the life raft got thrown overboard right away. Can't imagine what that must have felt like to have been thrown overboard. Without any, I guess you could be warned as much as possible, but given just how quickly everything is unfolding, given it would be very hard to issue enough warning ahead of time. Dennis Hale himself, like everybody else, was lacking direction along Huron's surface. In other words, lacking focus. However, for Dennis Hale, he was able to spot rising water bubbles that allowed him to stay on the proper course. Okay? The more water bubbles you see, then follow the course. Because you never know where it might take you, but by following what's in front of you, then you know that's a sign of improving your chances of survival. So, for Dennis Hale, he searched for crewmen nearby but couldn't spot anyone. He did see the raft that he had been on earlier, which he and everyone else along that raft had been ejected from. He saw the raft, but he saw it with nobody on there. So in other words, it was empty. Lake Huron's waves harassed Hale and did the same for everyone else to where the raft disappeared when falling into a hollow, or I should say a trough, between waves, only to reappear out of nowhere. So the waves are knocking the raft down, and just when it seems like the raft has disappeared altogether for good, it somehow resurfaces, but yet the relentless pounding of the waves is even wreaking havoc on a raft onto itself, because this raft alone, to me, it represents saving people's lives. The bigger question is, how many men can get to this raft? And would there be enough men to accommodate everyone? Think about this too. Whatever happened to those other two lifeboats? Well, what I do know is I can give you that information here shortly. How psychologically beaten down had Dennis Hale become after getting thrown overboard from the Morrell's bow? Well, if I were Dennis Hale, or anybody else for that matter, I think it'd be fair to say that I would be severely worn out. Beaten down. Beaten down beyond the sky ceiling. And I think it'd be fair to say that for a handful of the crewmen, they had probably never come across anything like this before. So this, to them, is the ultimate test of survival. So Dennis Hale was severely worn out given his initial time first spent within Lake Huron's icy waters had made it seem as though the general alarm got sounded long ago, when in actuality the exact opposite took place. The frigid weather left Hale the inability to feel anything pertaining to his body. In other words, he is undergoing numbness, folks. He, along with anybody else, at this moment, are lacking the means to think, feel, or react properly. Shock has set in, folks. Shock has set in probably to the point where, number one, you're not thinking properly, but two, you could be hallucinating. You could be doing so many other things that it's not so much a question of, you know, making you unbecoming, but it's just making you lose. It's making you lose all means of proper rationing. It's making you lose everything there is that you would normally have with you in a non-hostile environment. And what I mean by hostile environment in this case is that Mother Nature's fury is showing, or it's already shown, and now 29 men's lives are at stake. You know, November is the month when the skies turn gloomy and nothing is ever certain. So, you know, Dennis Hale and the other 28 men are not only in for the fight of their lives, but this is a battle against Mother Nature that will either see men a fair number of men survive, or we may see, say, fewer than five. I know I'm rambling on, but we just have to think to ourselves, what if it was us that was, what if it was any one of us in Lake Huron's waters right now at this time? What is going through our minds? But most of all, knowing that our means of being able to properly reason are very, very slim because of all the numbness and the frigid weather, not just the frigid weather, but the numbness that has set in terms of the inability to feel anything, not just with our bodies, folks, but lacking the means to think, feel, react. All those things now have been robbed of us. Well, I will say this, although the waves did wear Dennis Hale down, he was living in the moment. He still had the means to cope with it and pray for survival. Did Dennis Hale get saved shortly after being tossed overboard? I have some good news here, folks. The answer is yes. Two crewmen, being deckhands Art Stoichek and John Cleary Jr., got access to the raft, which Hale himself earlier tried in vain to secure, but couldn't. Stoichek and Cleary helped assist Hale on board. All right, here is a great step in the right direction. You know, two men have made it on the raft, and now they've pulled a third guy. They've pulled someone else, so now we've got three men, folks. Three men. Whereas Dennis Hale was wearing a heavy pea coat over his life jacket, Art Stoichek had a life jacket over his pajamas. John Cleary Jr. wore a life jacket over a sweatshirt and jeans. I'm kind of wondering now, okay, yes, Dennis Hale has the pea coat, the heavy pea coat over his life jacket. Art Stoechek has a life jacket over his pajamas, and John Cleary has his life jacket over a sweatshirt and jeans. We're just left to wonder, given that these other two men don't have a heavy pea coat, what will their chances of survival be like going forward, given that, you know, we don't know how long it's going to take before another freighter can come to the assistance of those whom are stranded? I mean, it's just one of many questions, but it is something we have to think about now. What I found interesting about John Cleary Jr. and Art Stoechek is that they were each, is that both men were serving their first year along the lakes. Cleary held on quietly to the raft, and Stoechek remained worried about the overall chances for survival. Of the three men, folks, Dennis Hale is the most experienced with regards to leadership. So these three men are going to need to work together as a team, but obviously if you are Art Stoechek or John Cleary Jr., you definitely need to look up to Dennis Hale for advice. And Dennis Hale, at the same time, I'm sure could learn a few things probably from these new guys as well. This is where teamwork has to pay dividends. Even when it's not an emergency, the entire crew must know how to work together. But now that the odds are at stake, even more so, survival is going to become all the more paramount. The raft, which Hale, Stoechek, and Cleary were aboard on, consisted of the storage compartment. The storage compartment, it was the place where the parachute and handheld flares were secured. If other vessels were spotted nearby, the use of flares would come greatly into play, but deployment of flares would have to be done sooner versus later. How so? There's a thing called hypothermia, folks, being the loss of heat in a person's body. So if these flares don't get put into play sooner, if we try to use these flares later, hypothermia will take over to the point where we're not going to be able to even know how to properly use the flares, and then our chances of being detected, spotted by another freighter, the chances become all the more slimmer. So there again, folks, you know, we think we have time even when we're fighting for our own means of survival, but we really don't. Would any other crewmen get pulled from the water? Yes, one being Charles Fuzzy Fossbender. Fuzzy was his nickname, but his real name was Charles Fossbender, whom was the Morrell's wheelsman. He was pulled over by Art Stoechek and John Cleary. Charles Fossbender was on the Morrell's uppermost deck, being that of the pilot house, when the SS Morrell began splitting in two. He was fully clothed, but just like Hale, Cleary, and Stoechek, Fossbender himself was also very disheveled, as well as enduring shock. And who would not have been enduring some form of shock to being disheveled? I mean, if anybody hasn't experienced at this point being shocked, in a state of shock, or being disheveled, then I honestly don't know what kind of answer I could give to that for that person. But I would strongly say that just about anybody, regardless of vessel, in experiencing something like this, yes, you would be in a pure state of shock. I know I would. What became of opening the raft's storage cabinet? It became, folks, a daunting challenge. How so? I mean, it shouldn't be hard probably to open up the storage cabinet. Well, it was a daunting challenge given the raft itself got damaged when tossed overboard. Okay, well, if the raft got tossed overboard, did the storage unit endure any kind of damage. The door to the storage unit, folks, got dented. And we're not talking a little dent like you find canned goods, for example, canned vegetables. I didn't see a picture, obviously, that there wouldn't have been, although I did see a picture in the book of the bow and the stern, and really the midsection just coming apart altogether. But I did see where the raft was, where there were men clinging on to the raft. But obviously, this was not your ordinary typical raft that you might have out on the beach or in a swimming pool. This is obviously a state-of-the-art raft for its time in 1966. But obviously, this dent had to have been pretty severe, because it just so happens that all four men had to work tirelessly to fix the dented door. So it wasn't like a five-minute fix, folks. I mean, we probably could have been looking at maybe 30 minutes at most. If all four men are having to work tirelessly to fix the dented door, that means that it'd probably be fair to say that each of them took a turn at it. Well, it turns out that luck did pave their way. Dennis Hale was able to take out the flare gun, including two out of the six parachute flares. He shot off two flares into the air, but upon firing, the flare gun, sadly, folks, broke apart into two pieces. It's probably fair to say that that with the frigid temperatures, that maybe even the flare guns themselves were not vulnerable to withstanding the elements of Mother Nature. That's just my theory. The Morrell's bow, the front section, folks, was just a couple hundred yards away from the raft. And the bow, folks, finally began to sink, whereas the stern remained afloat in the water and sailed away from the bow and the raft. The lifeboats that still remained along the stern, being those two lifeboats, for those men clinging for life aboard the stern section, they were unable to launch the lifeboats due to gale force winds. Remember, folks, those gale force winds go at run between 39 to 54 miles per hour, 39 to 54 miles per hour, but can exceed the threshold of 54 mile per hour maximum wind. So obviously, on the morning of November 29th, from what I read, the gale force winds were at 70 miles an hour, along with the 25-foot wave. So I don't see how in the world anybody could launch. Yes, you want to make every effort there is, even under the most daunting of circumstances, but given that the winds are 70 miles per hour or just over that mark, I don't see how anybody in their right mind could successfully launch a lifeboat. Is it fair to say that had the winds been at 40 miles an hour and say the waves were less than 25 feet, say they were coming at, say, between 10 to 15 feet, and there was imminent danger around you, could those lifeboats have been launched? I think there's a better likelihood that they could have been, but that's just me. But they would have had to have been launched they would have had to have been launched very quickly, given that time is a very crucial factor between life and death, making all the difference between life and death, I should say. So yes, sadly, for those men clinging for their lives aboard the stern section, they were unable to launch the two lifeboats due to the gale force winds, including the heavy seas being the 25-foot waves. On top of numbness stood uncertainty over where the raft and the Morrell's two sections were located distance-wise from one another, as well as lack of solid focus upon exact positioning of where the raft actually was on Lake Huron, to chances of getting found alive. All of these things now, folks, are just coming at these four men. I mean, they are lucky to be alive, But they have so many questions left. In other words, are we going to live to see tomorrow? Are we going to be able to not only live to see tomorrow, but are we going to be reunited with our families? Will we be able to celebrate more good times ahead with our families, or just, you know, with loved ones? And when we do get rescued, are we going to get proper care right away? I mean, I would think that you would if you were rescued right away. But even if you are rescued right away, what are the chances of survival? I mean, am I going to make it through the night? So, yes, all of these thoughts, you know, a lack of solid focus, not knowing the exact positioning of where your raft is positioned on Lake Huron, given that Lake Huron is big. It's the second biggest lake. Matter of fact, if it weren't for Georgia, Georgian Bay on Lake Huron, Lake Michigan would be the second biggest lake behind Superior. That's the main one of the big reasons why Lake Huron is bigger than Lake Michigan and second to Superior, because of Georgian Bay, which is more so on the Canadian side. To wrap up this podcast segment episode, all four men lay stranded along one of the largest freshwater bodies of water in the world. Can you imagine being stranded on one of the largest freshwater bodies of water in the world? And, well, I think it'd be very awkward in broad daylight to be stranded. Although it would be fair to say that you might have better means of being spotted in daylight than you would at nighttime. But at the same time, we don't get to control our circumstances and what happens. So now that we are stranded not only on the largest freshwater body of water in the world, but it's in the middle of the night, we don't have cell phones, folks. We have no means of... yes, the only means that we would have are those flares, but at the same time, the flare gun got broken apart into two pieces, despite Dennis Hale's best efforts to fire the flare gun. So now that we have a broken flare gun, we have to ask ourselves, how are we going to not only keep ourselves alive, but how are we going to seek warmth? How are we going to seek shelter on this raft? One thing I can think of is that perhaps all four men will need to huddle very close to one another for warmth purposes. While that is a good solution, the bigger question might be is how long can four men huddling together for warmth purposes ensure that all four men will survive to live to see another day? That's perhaps the million-dollar question. Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this episode, and when I'm on the air again next, we will continue with the discussion with what is called Lost. We will find out if any other vessels had experienced similar struggles in this storm that wreaked havoc on Lake Huron. We will also learn if, in fact, a search and rescue mission did go about taking place. Thank you for your time, as always, and no matter where you live in the world, continue to stay safe and have a great weekend. And thanks once again for being such ardent listeners. Without you guys, I don't know where I would be, but I thank you for being such great learners. You all have made this very possible. Take care and stay safe.